You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln shared 200th birthdays yesterday. Adam Gopnik's new book, Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life, uses this bicentennial coincidence to explore the extraordinary influence these two men had in shaping a modern world. Mr. Gopnik has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1986. Angels and Ages is his third book. It is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome Adam Gopnik back to the show. Hello.
It's great to be here, Leonard.
And that title, Angels and Ages, refers to a debate about what was actually said at Lincoln's deathbed. How did the debate begin?
It's a funny little historical dispute. We all learned in school, or at least I did, that when Lincoln drew his last breath at 7 in the morning on April 15th, Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, said, now he belongs to the ages, which is a beautiful piece of American neoclassical rhetoric. But it turns out, and several right-leaning, if not right-wing historians in the last few years have revived the idea that what Stanton actually said was, now he belongs to the angels. And in fact, one of the best contemporary records we have of the guy who was taking shorthand says, yes, he said, now he belongs to the angels. In some ways, it's a trivial dispute, but it's a wonderful symbolic lever that gets you thinking about the real subject of this book, which is the transformation of liberal consciousness in the middle of the 19th century. Because if Stanton said, now he belongs to the angels, then obviously he's thinking of Lincoln as a figure who's who's under the verdict of heaven. If he says now he belongs to the ages, he's thinking of him in a very different way, as a figure whose ultimate verdict will come through history.
And you see both of these characters as cusp figures.
Exactly so. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm after in this book, Leonard, is that they are on the cusp between the Enlightenment ideas of liberalism, of the founding fathers or of the first theorists of liberalism, and modernity, our inheritance. And that's exactly it. They're cusp figures. They're men who, by no means alone, I mean, we could fill this out with many, many other men and women, but who exemplify that transformation in the way we think about the world. And as I say in the book, who exemplify the way that liberal optimism got a tragic consciousness.
And you seem to be claiming that they may have a greater influence than the two men most people would cite when we talk about the people who changed the way we see the world, Marx and Freud.
I think that's true now. I think one of the truths about the last 20 years is that the Marxist model has proven to be a moral failure. And the Freudian model, long, complicated question to have, but certainly the majority of cognitive psychologists now certainly would agree, has been an empirical failure. Whereas Darwin's ideas have never been more potent or more widely accepted or more generative for new work in the sciences than they are now. And certainly Lincoln's example of the possibility of a fighting liberalism, a liberalism for good or ill, that manages to defend itself and propagate itself, is certainly a living idea.
As we discovered after Barack Obama was elected, and we saw as many pictures of Lincoln as we saw of Barack Obama.
Yes, it's hard to think of another historical figure who could be that contemporary, called on for contemporary examples as Lincoln is now.
Did Darwin and Lincoln's shared birthday inspire you to explore their lives together, or was it just a lucky coincidence that you came across in your research?
To be completely truthful, I was fascinated by both men. I'd written an essay for The New Yorker about Darwin as a natural novelist, Darwin as a writer, and then I wrote something about the Angels and Ages dispute, which is also about language, really, about words and how they affect minds. And then I discovered the common birthday, and I thought, well, this is an occasion to put it together, not to demonstrate mystic parallels between these two lives, none exist, but as a way of writing a meditation on their legacy to us, what they've given us.
Well, but you say that what they do have in common and their greatest influence is in revolutionizing the way in which ideas are communicated.
Yeah, I think,
how had they been communicated previously?
I think that if you think about Darwin, for instance, Darwin's On the Origin of Species, when it's published in 1859, is one of the first, if not the very first, and certainly still distinctly powerful as a major work of scientific investigation research, which is also a popular book. It's published as a popular book. Darwin never publishes it as an expert book for expert readers. The first edition of Origin of Species, which contains his idea and his argument for it, is published for a broad audience and sells out on the first morning. That's a real transformation in the way we think about who science is addressed to and where it belongs. And that idea that not only is it important to have a strong idea, but it's important to communicate it to as large an audience as you can, that's a modern idea.
But not just ideas. You say they use their simple building blocks in the way they lay out their ideas to evoke large ideals.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that there's a moral, a set of moral consciousness, a set of values that runs through both of their work, and I think that that's crucial to it. We don't see it. Darwin's not a polemicist, and he's not an evangelist for a particular set of morals.
Did Darwin actually set out to change the way you wrote a book about science or scientific theory?
I don't know how self-conscious it was. It certainly seemed natural for him to write it that way. Remember, he had written his account of the Voyage of the Beagle. It was a successful book, and I think it became natural for him, intuitive, just in the same way that for Lincoln, the way you communicated ideas was by making speeches. That was part of his role, who he was.
He must have understood how threatening the theory of evolution would be to many people. Do you think that affected the way he built his argument?
I do. I do. It's one of the fascinating questions in the history of ideas. Why did Darwin delay? He really has this idea in 1838, doesn't publish it.
For 20 years.
For 1859. That's right. And certainly he was a sensitive man who didn't like being at the center of controversy. He had, his wife was all her life a believing Christian, and he didn't want to hurt her. I think Darwin's desire, in a funny way, Leonard, to avoid a fight, gives On the Origin of Species a very special explanatory pleading, come along with me tone, not a I'll tell you the truth and the hell with you, but please, if you just follow me, you'll see that this is a good idea and it needn't threaten values you hold dear.
You're right that Darwin made dog breeders and pigeon owners the peers of scientists.
Yes, that's right.
To make it more accessible to people?
To prove his idea, and then I think to make it more eloquent and accessible to people. He had his great idea, but he knew that the great idea was valueless without evidence to show it. And he loved evidence from the near at hand, from things that we already know. So he would say, in effect, look, you accept that dog breeders can take big, woofy dogs and turn them into small, yappy dogs just by a process of artificial selection. And you say, yes. And he knew a great deal about it. He learned a lot about it. And he said, well, if you accept that, then why not accept that given an immeasurably long span of time, nature can make natural selection do the same kind of work?
And he structured his argument in a way that you say influenced, kind of shapes the modern way of thinking.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a way that
we see a break?
A break between what and what?
Before and after?
History doesn't work in big fractures, and there's continuities connect things as much as breaks do. But yes, I certainly think that Darwin not only reshapes biology, but he reshapes our expectations of the way we can talk about biology. It's one of the reasons, Leonard, that we see every day another book of popular evolutionary biology is published, Steve Pinker or Richard Dawkins, someone else. And those books are read and cherished, and educated people feel an obligation to understand those ideas.
Well, there were other people who were starting to come up with similar ideas, and it's one of the reasons I gathered that he eventually published On the Origin of Species. We should also assume that if Lincoln hadn't ended slavery, another president would have had to eventually, because slavery was just too divisive in this country. So there's something else that's going on here. The reason that we remember these men is not just because of their accomplishment, but because of the way they accomplished it.
Exactly so. I mean, Gregor Mendel came up with a theory of genetics, which in certain ways is as big an idea as Darwin's idea, but we don't talk about Mendelism in the same way we talk about Darwinism, because it's not tied to a kind of humanism the way Darwin's is. And in the same way, yeah, it's certainly true, inevitably true, that slavery would have ended without Lincoln. But Lincoln gives us a set of words that, as the Obama moment shows, we still resonate to. So the words with both these men are not ornament or embroidery. They're at the very core of what they're doing.
My guest is Adam Gopnik, whose latest book is Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. It's published by Knopp. And since you mentioned Mendel, you point out that we don't call Newton's theory of gravity Newtonism. We don't call Einstein's theory of relativity Einsteinism. So why do we call the theory of evolution Darwinism?
Well, some evolutionary biologists would prefer that we didn't call it that because they think it conflates, it gets mixed up, Darwin's own life with their ideas. I think there are two reasons. One is a bad reason, which is that people like to attack Darwin, and they think by attacking Darwin they can attack evolution biology. The good reason is exactly, as I try to explain, because Darwin is the author of On the Origin of Species, which isn't just a monument in the sciences. It's a monument in humane letters. It's a book that, even if it were proven wrong, would still exemplify the ideal way of creating an argument, sympathizing with counterarguments, persuading. It's the eloquence of explanation in Darwin that moves us.
And the same thing with Lincoln. How was his style of communication revolutionary?
I don't know if revolutionary is the word I'd want, but certainly was original and powerful. Lincoln, you know, is interesting amongst, if you read, a perfect contrast. The real oration at Gettysburg was given by a great orator named Edward Everett, and it's a series of classical parallels between Pericles' Athens and the Northern Republic. And Lincoln, by contrast, has a short and sweet speech that doesn't draw on classical parallels, that draws on a very clear, almost biblical, Shakespearean, if you like, reasoning. It's a little soliloquy about freedom and war and about why slavery, which he never mentions, is at the center of the dispute. That kind of lucidity, that kind of clarity and simplicity was Lincoln's special contribution to the American vernacular.
He's almost laying it out in legal terms.
Exactly so. All those great speeches, the Gettysburg Address, the second inaugural, are filled with conditionals. If you accept this premise, then this flows from it. And if this flows from it, then we have to arrive at the conclusion that what's at stake here is government of the people, by the people, and so forth.
Weren't Lincoln and Darwin both affected by deaths on both personal and on larger scale?
Absolutely. And I think that that's central to understanding them. Both of them lost a child, a favorite child, at a cruel age. Darwin lost his daughter Annie when she was 10, Lincoln his son Willie when he was 11. And more broadly, they both became acutely conscious of the force of mortality. Lincoln, obviously, through the Civil War. Darwin, because his idea of evolution wasn't that things naturally improved. It was that death, the wedge of death, as he called it, was the great sorter out of species. And so they had to confront death and still find a way of saving a belief in progress in the omnipresent face of death.
Well, many people lost children in the 19th century. It was almost commonplace.
Didn't
that make it easier for them to accept?
I think that's one of the greatest and cruelest historical myths that there is. Certainly when we look at Darwin and Lincoln as typical men of their time, they were bereft. They were inconsolable when they lost kids. That's something people like to say. There's zero evidence that anyone actually felt that way.
And both of them were afflicted by what might be seen as modern psychological problems. Darwin had anxiety attacks. Lincoln suffered from depression. I wonder what would have happened if they had lived in a time of psychopharmaceuticals.
They probably would have been less accomplished. Lincoln's melancholy is essential to who Lincoln is. It makes him capable of compassion for the dead that he's responsible for. And Darwin's anxiety is one of the things, I think, that feeds the wonderfully rich, explanatory, pleading, anti-arrogant tone in all of his work.
Now, Lincoln does cite religious influences in his speeches. Darwin, I get the sense, perhaps was moving toward an agnosticism, maybe even atheism, as he went on in years. But what about religion? What role did it play in these men's lives?
It's a kind of beautiful thing to see. They're like kind of comets crossing in opposite directions across the sky, Leonard, because Lincoln was an atheist, an aggressive atheist as a young man, who through death and the war became a kind of mystic. He came to believe in a kind of Job-like endurance of Providence's plan. Darwin went just the opposite direction. He went from being a fairly complacent Anglican, then a Unitarian, to being a true agnostic who thought that there was nothing for us except a kind of stoic contemplation of the enormity of time. So they both move in opposite directions, one towards religion, one away from religion, through very similar experiences.
Adam Gopnik's book, Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you, Leonard.